Welcome to ApplauseCast. Tonight, Stephen Mara and Bill Hedge of ApplauseCast interview Afro-Cuban and jazz percussionist, lecturer, and educator Michael Spiro. Michael's recording and performing credits include such diverse artists as David Byrne, The Caribbean Jazz Project, Ella Fitzgerald, David Garibaldi, Bobby Hutcherson, Dr. John, Bobby McFerrin, Andy Norell, Carlos Santana, Grace Slick, Clark Terry, McCoy Tyner, and the Rolling Stones' Charlie Watts. In addition, he recorded soundtracks to such major motion pictures as Soap Dish, Henry and June, True Stories, Sworn to the Drum, Walker, Eddie Macon's Run, and Dragon, The Life of Bruce Lee, and also wrote several arrangements for the Tony Award-winning Broadway show Blast. Join us now for a wide-ranging discussion with Michael Spiro as he gives us insight into the creative process and his life as a working musician. I'm Bill Hedge of ApplauseCast.
I'm Steve Mara with ApplauseCast.
And I'm Mike Spiro, about to be of ApplauseCast.
Mike, tell us about your music, where you started, how you got from point A to point B, which is here with us.
Yeah, well, point A, I guess, was... I didn't start playing till very late, comparatively, in life. I was almost 20 when I started. So from a musical standpoint, I grew up on black American music, James Brown and Motown and all that there.
The Funk
and
Brothers.
Stax.
And the Funk Brothers.
That's right. And Stax and so forth. I was, I think, probably the world's greatest air drummer between the ages of 10 and 19. Then at some point, I was going to college at the University of California in Santa Cruz, and I moved into a house filled with musicians. They had a band. This was back in the day where, 68 people all lived in one house. When they were gone or, out of the house or whatever, I would sneak away and bang away in this guy's drum set. I had no idea what I was doing, but one day when I was banging away in this guy's drum set, the band came back and went, "We didn't know you played drums." I said, I don't. "You sound great, man. You need to play. And I was like, okay. And I kind of stupidly at the time thought, well, everybody plays drum set. By the time I learn to play drum set, I'll be too old to play with anybody. So I know what I'll do. I'll buy some Congo drums.
Congo
but,
drums?
Well, yeah. Or Kungas, depending on which part of the country you're from. The bass player in that band drove me up to Leo's Music in Oakland at the time, and I bought a set of conga drums.
Ever played anything like that
before? No. Okay. Never in my life.
Sort of impulse buy.
Yeah.
Okay.
10 days later, they put me in their band, and a week later, I actually did a gig. So I'd been playing for 2 weeks, and there I was. And at the end of the gig, somebody walked up to me and, gave me, I think it was $15. And I thought, you mean you can have that much fun and get paid? It kind of ruined my life. And what you see before you is the result of that ruination. I did, however, since I didn't know what I was doing, particularly my instrument, the conga drum, which is, as they used to say in the day, skin on skin. If you don't know what you're doing, you discover that the day after a gig, your hands look like they got run over by a truck. And they certainly felt that way. So I figured there must be somebody that could show me how to, I must be doing something wrong. And so I went to a teacher up here in the Bay Area. He gave me a record of some Afro-Cuban folkloric music, some music much basically of the people you see on the walls around you at the time. And I can't say that I was in love with it. My goal, of course, was to be Aretha Franklin's conga drummer. That's all I wanted to do. But I was fascinated by it because I couldn't make any sense out of it. But they all started at the same time. They all ended at the same time. So they must have known what the hell was going on, even if I didn't. And then maybe good booze or good wine or whatever. First you kind of go, what's the big deal? And then a year later, you're an addict. And so I just became an Afro-Cuban music junkie and still am.
So did you continue taking lessons?
Oh, yeah. And that meant then I studied here for a number of years. And then I figured, well, I better go to the big Mecca, which back in the 70s was New York City. So I went to New York and studied, and then eventually went to Cuba, which in the early 80s was still Mecca, meaning nobody could go, nobody thought about going to Cuba, really. People had gone to Cuba to work on the Vincent Amos Brigade. I don't know if that means that mm-hmm. means anything to you. So in other words, Cuba was where you went if you were politically inclined. And I'm an old lefty, so I had certainly connections to a lot of people who went to Cuba. But that was sort of a, nobody else went to Cuba. It never occurred to anybody that you could go. How would you?
Now, I did, but yeah. It was courtesy of the United States Navy.
And what year was that?
It was early 80s.
And was it Guantanamo exclusively?
Yeah, it was in Guantanamo.
Yeah. So, I mean, although you and I would both know that's Cuba, nobody else
right.
does, and you didn't get outside of the
I never
compound.
No, I did not. I drank a lot of beer.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
But my first trip to Cuba was 1984. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you asked anybody that you might run into now that you're working with Michael, ask any of the North Americans, I don't mean the Cubans themselves who are here now, but how many of you went to Cuba in 1984? The answer will be zero.
Mm-hmm.
So I just one day woke up and went, well, if I'm going to play Cuban music, I better go to Cuba. So I flew to Mexico City and walked up to the Cuban Air Cubana counter and went, how do I go to Cuba? And thinking they were going to say, well, you've got to go to the
sign
embassy.
This form.
But in the embassy in Mexico City, which of course, as if you could ever find that, how do you find anything in Mexico City? I don't know. And they went, oh, there's a plane leaving in an hour. Just get on the plane. And I went, well, I'm an American citizen. Yeah, no, what? There'll be a visa waiting for you when you get to the airport in La Habana. And there was.
Now, did you know anybody in Cuba?
No, I didn't know one person. Pretty interesting story. I went in 84, and starting in about 1982, I sort of began to apprentice myself to this very famous Afro-Cuban drummer here in this country named Francisco Aguabella, whose pictures are on the wall around here, and a very famous musician. And the only thing that before I went to Cuba, I had asked him, where do I go? He said, okay, well, I'll give you the name of this one guy in my hometown. So I end up in Cuba and I don't know a soul and I don't know how I'm supposed to get to this town and I don't know anything. I go into the breakfast line at my hotel and I purposely wear a bunch of, I'll call it paraphernalia. You sort of saw my altar over in the corner, and there's all kinds of various paraphernalia that might identify one as associated with that kind of stuff. And normally I either don't wear it or it goes inside your shirt, and I just put it on.
You became a billboard.
Yeah, on purpose, because I wanted to attract attention to myself. And sure enough, I went through the breakfast line, and so now I'm sitting at my table eating my breakfast, and the two guys who were serving were just like, you know, pointing at me, and so I thought, well, what the hell? So I went up to them and I said, look, I can see you guys are talking about me. By any chance, would you happen to know this guy? And this one guy doesn't even answer me. He just turns to his partner, takes his apron off and says, I'll be back tomorrow. And he says, come with me. And he takes me on a bus, and we travel about 60 kilometers, and he literally takes me to this guy's house. And I get to this guy's house, and in Cuba, the doors open onto the street, but the house part is towards the back. And so, you know, we knock on the door, and the guy opens the door, and he sees me, and I don't think he'd seen anybody that looks like I do, maybe ever, but certainly not in recent
history. Did you have drums with you?
No, no. So he came to the door and I said, hi.
So you could have been selling encyclopedia.
Well, not that.
They don't know who you are.
If you were an East German, blue eyes,
yeah,
brown hair.
Yeah. But even then, in this town and in that neighborhood, it is all black Cuban. There aren't even white Cubans, let alone East. I mean, you know, it's one. We're not in Havana. We're not in a major urban area. There's no reason for somebody. It's like, you know, somebody who's comes to America as a tourist. You don't go to Dayton, Ohio.
There's right.
What would you be doing there?
Mm-hmm.
So he answers the door, and I say, "Excuse me. My name is Michael Spiro, and I'm a student of Francisco Aguabella's." And he just basically looked at me and said, "No, you're not," and he shut the door. Now, then what do you do? So I decided to knock on the door again. And now I'm, you know, wetting in my pants, mm-hmm. quite literally. Pretty terrified, you know, at what the possible outcome could be. And I said, look, I'm not trying to be disrespectful and I'm not trying to be rude, but really, no, I'm study with this.
Are you speaking English?
No, I'm saying Spanish.
Spanish, okay. Yeah.
So he doesn't even sort of acknowledge that I exist. He just turns around and yells, Alberto, go get the drums. And the next thing I know is in the back, and he hasn't let me in from the street yet. I'm still standing on what I guess we would call a sidewalk. And he hasn't said, come in and sit down. I'm just standing there. And so his son goes and gets the drums. And then they put three chairs right by the entrance to the door. And now I realize, well, here it is.
Audition.
Audition time. You're either, you either can play ball or you can't. And this kind of drumming, it's these three drums that you see up there, and it's a certain style, and it's a very classical thing. And if you don't know it, there's no fake in it, because it's sort of like Mozart. Either you're playing the concerto or you're not. So when I proved that I knew and could play the concerto, this guy got up, hugged me like I was his kid, and then the whole town showed up to see the white guy from America that could do all this stuff. In that sense, the rest is history, because then I sort of got taken in like family. So now I sort of am family. I'm the godfather to a couple of kids there, and all these people that you see on the walls are, my aunts, uncles, cousins, mm-hmm. fathers, etc. Once you have that kind of a relationship, then you keep going back, and then you learn more, and then the more you learn, the more you play, and then the more you play, it feeds on itself. My work, and the work meaning the recordings and so forth and so on, are in many ways a function of this. Well, if I play Cuban music, I guess I better go to Cuba, and having all that stuff happen.
There's a certain logic to that.
Yeah. I'm sort of, I guess, the American guy who went native, and never quite came back.
What's your sense about how many players who do the kind of music you play have that kind of experience? In other words, do they go to Cuba? Do they go to particular places to learn from the originators of that style of music?
Yeah, well, that, though not true when I first went, I think that changed in the 90s when Fidel, in particular, when the Soviet Union collapsed, Fidel's only income was from tourism. And then at that point, they started workshops and all these various things that you could go to Cuba to study. So not only musicians, but dancers. So a number of Americans traveled to Cuba to study music, study dance, study folklore. There are a number of people younger than me, like in their mid-30s maybe, who've been to Cuba several times. I've been to Cuba probably 20 times. Maybe it's an exaggeration. I don't know. A lot. Since 1984, which was my first trip. Although there are some who maybe have had as much time going and coming back as I have, not that many. And there are some, who got married and live in Cuba. Not many. But
I think the other thing that probably happened, whenever it was, 5 years ago, was the whole thing with Ry Cooter in the Buena Vista Social Club.
But that didn't necessarily mean that people went.
They didn't go, but there was much more of an awareness of that style of music.
I do think what happened is that people learned that actually just go to Cancun and get on a plane and come back and then fly from Cancun back to the States. And for a while, the U.S. government didn't give a shit. So they just kind of ignored it. Mm-hmm. When Bush came to power, that has changed dramatically. And in fact, there are a number of cases that do happen where they try to make it an example of somebody and they fine him $15,000, for going to Cuba for a week. Cuba's part of the axis of evil. If you were to travel to Cuba, you would have to be very, very careful.
I think a lot of people go through Canada from North
But
America.
Equally as, I know a number of people that have been busted coming from Montreal and Toronto back into the States.
So when the Buena Vista Social Club was in prominence and Ry Cooter did all of that, I'm not sure, what was that, 5 years ago, 6 years
Longer.
Ago?
You're Longer. Now, it's almost 10 years ago.
Is it?
Now. Yeah.
10 years?
Times.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, because some of those people are still performing.
Some.
The ones that are alive.
But that's the point.
They were old.
Yeah, they were old then, and now they're dead.
They're dead, yeah.
Ruben Gonzalez died. Yeah. Compay Segundo died. I think Ibrahim is still alive, but a number of the Pio Leyva just died. Number of those people have died within the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, they were in their 80s.
Yeah. I mean, part of what was so captivating about that film or that DVD, in addition to it just sounded dynamite, was just how the age of these people. Because if you closed your eyes and just listened, and then I remember the first time I saw it, it was like there's hope for getting old.
Well, and I think it's interesting you say that, because for somebody like me, that really was the whole... It wasn't like... I mean, you know, it was sort of funny for those of us who've been playing Cuban music for all these years. You know, it was sort of like somebody rushing into the Istanbul radio station to say they've discovered this great new music and they put on a Count Basie record. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I don't know how to tell you this, folks, but it's been around for about 50 years. The fact that you just discovered it is very nice.
Well,
but
the fact it was Ry Cooder. I mean, the fact that it was...
Yeah, but the point is, so for us, it wasn't like, wow, here's this new thing, as much as it was, hey, these old guys are going to get to make a buck, you know, and play music that some of us still love and think that it's great that these guys get a chance to travel a little bit. And
it's stunning music. I mean, I was just listening to it the other day again.
It's great.
Yeah.
You know, it's classic music.
Yeah.
Just as Basie is classic music. How could Count Basie ever get old?
Mm-hmm.
That's our roots. That's who we are as Americans.
So what was it that captivated you so much about that particular type of music?
You mean Cuban music?
Yeah, Cuban music, yeah.
Well, I think for me, if you into rhythm, you're going to have to come to Cuba eventually. Obviously, Cuban music has roots in Africa. I don't mean to suggest that, you know, Africa isn't a part of the equation. But I would say that the Cuban take on, New World take on African rhythm is unique and spectacular. And obviously one could perhaps easily say, well, that's just your own, you know, subjective bias. And obviously to a large degree that would be true. But I think also there is some objective criteria by which one could say that Cuban percussion is unique in the way the music is organized. And from my perspective, it will be the challenge of my life. If you could play this, you could play anything.
Not being a musician and being a consumer of music, I can't articulate what it is about that particular style of music that's so appealing, but it sure is.
Yeah, the thing for me is that with any culture, I suppose, the more you explore it, the more it's not Cuban style, but then it becomes Cuban styles, plural.
Yeah.
What we refer to as popular forms, meaning dance music like the Buena Vista Social Club.
Mm.
And then what we refer to as folkloric forms, which tend to be much, much less for popular consumption and much more for, usually for sacred contexts, though not exclusively by any means, but where that's music of certain, of Afro-Cuban tradition that you're not going to see that on TV, even in Cuba for that matter, let alone anywhere else. But at the end of the day, art is an objective experience. I mean, a subjective experience, not an objective experience. And we can study all the paintings in the world. I don't want anybody to tell me that I can't say, I don't like that painting because I didn't major in art at a university. I have this discussion, by the way, with people all the time. I have lots of friends who aren't musicians. And, you know, when they say, oh, we went to go hear so-and-so. And I'll say, how was it? And of course, the first thing they'll say is, well, I'm not a musician. And I go, and why would that,
you like it?
Why would that matter? I don't make films, but I think I'm allowed to have my opinion. I liked the movie. I didn't like the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say, well, you know, if the camera angle on that one shot had only been, it's all bullshit. You know, we have our own subjective response to art, of which music is a part of that. And I try to tell all my friends, in fact, it's probably better that you don't know anything about music. All I wanted to know was, did you like it or not? And one of the drags about being a musician, for example, is it's hard to go hear anything and like it anymore because you can't turn off your critical mind enough to just enjoy it. And I make a conscious effort to do that when I go out. I don't want to bring all that critical thinking. So I think that from most people, of course, would say that they like Cuban music because it's so rhythmically fulfilling.
That's what I would think. It's, and I don't mean this in any kind of derogatory, but there's something that's basic and sort of like at the DNA level.
Absolutely.
I mean, like, how can you sit still?
Precisely.
When you hear that.
Precisely. A great movie, for example, I think, is a movie that I go and love it. Meanwhile, you know, some Academy Award-winning director goes, that was a great film. In other words, you appeal to your fellow colleagues, your fellow craftspeople, and just Joe. Joe says, what a great flick. I mean, I think the goal is of course, you want to speak to your colleague. You want to speak to your peer. My criteria when I make a record, for example, then is, yes, I want the guy who's really into Afro-Cuban percussion, you know, the other three people in the world like myself to go, what a great record. But I'm quite serious what I'm about to say. I want my mom to go, I really like your record. You know, I don't know what it was. I can't tell you any of the language that it was about, blah, 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 but I put it on when I fill in the blank, do the laundry, cook dinner, you know, and it just makes me feel good. Well, then I feel that I've been successful. I've been able to put out something that functions on all these different levels. So, yeah, I do think there's something basic, somewhat primal about that stuff. And then someone else can sit and analyze, well, notice that on the end of three where the accent falls there and see how that would be so different then. That's fine. That's what we all get to do as critics. But at the end of the day, did you move? Did you shake your ass or not?
You know, when I'm also in the process of doing a film, and I find sometimes now when I'm watching a film, like no one at my house wants to watch movies with Daddy anymore because right. It's the same, you know, God, I could have done that, et cetera. Yeah. Or I can talk about how we've got little chunks of film segments and how we keep track of those and make sure this didn't happen that. But it's not about that at all. I like talking to that about other people who do films in the same way a musician probably likes to talk about that. But at the end of the day, someone's going to watch that and say, gee, that was great. Or that sucked.
Yeah. And that really is, I mean, shop talk is, we it's all fun. Do shop talk. That's what we do.
But that's not the final product.
But at the end of the day, somebody comes in, sits down, takes their shoes off, put their feet up and they go, what a cool flick.
Yeah.
They're paying no attention to your camera angle or, you know, and if you
don't even want them to be aware of that.
Exactly. In fact, that's the point, right? The best, it's this the deal of if nobody's paid any attention to it, then you did a really good job.
Yeah. If you pull them away from reality, their reality.
Precisely.
And put them into a new one.
Then you've succeeded.
Then you succeed.
Right. Now you have to be conscious of how to do that, which is why the shop talk and the skill becomes important. But you don't want the person watching it to pay any attention to that. So, yes, what you do want, though, is if you then succeed, you want your peer, I think, to go, pretty hip camera angle, buddy.
No kidding.
You really pulled that off.
Absolutely.
Of course, we all have egos. Yeah. We wouldn't do what we do without the ego. We want the respect of our peers. So, of course, we want to make a record that has the respect of our peers. Or, I mean, some people don't. Some people just want to make a buck. I've never just wanted to make a buck. I do want the respect of my peers. But I also want somebody to make a cup of coffee on Sunday, pull out the New York Times, sit back, and every once in a while, I'll glance up as they're listening to my record in the background and go, wow, that was nice. And then go right back to it. You know, I don't need them to know all the stuff that went into doing it. I think Cuban music has a certain thing about it that will grab you, whether you know anything about it or not. Obviously, that's a subjective response that you and I have. Other people may go, what's all that banging going on?
But, you know, I've listened to other world-type music. Drumming or whatever. I mean, I just picked up a CD the other day from Morocco.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah. But it didn't.
No.
Yeah.
My foot wasn't moving.
But one could argue that, I mean, I could do a whole historical thing on why as an American, you've already been exposed to so much Cuban music without you even knowing that it was Cuban music, that you're already, you know, kind of in the, when you hear that, you kind of know where it is and your foot will tap because it's so forth and so on. Whereas Moroccan stuff, I'm like you.
It sounded kind of alien.
But if you had been raised in Spain.
It would be cool.
You might be going, yeah, that's great. So you have to remember that the relationship between the United States and Cuba has been well over 100 years old, and you've been exposed to stuff that you wouldn't even know was Cuban unless I gave you a lecture on it, you know, would bore you to tears anyhow.
But the Latin influence is, I agree, is much closer to this than
exactly. Precisely.
Morocco.
You're more likely to respond to stuff that's already in you, even though you don't know it's in you. So we are tuned to a rhythmic, somehow subconscious rhythmic understanding from Latin America. We are not attuned to a subconscious tonal thing, and all that music is microtonal.
So, Mike, what are we going to hear now?
This is the first track off of my most recent CD. The CD is called Bata Mbira, and I sort of have become famous in my little world for mixing cultures. Not because, again, that's ever my intent. It's just kind of what happens. I met a guy who plays the mbira, which here we kind of call the African thumb piano. And I just thought he was a tremendously skilled musician. And as he was playing some of his stuff for me, I kept hearing all this percussion that I play behind it, underneath it, on top of it. And so we ended up making a CD together. And this is the blending of music from Zimbabwe, the Shona people of Zimbabwe, with Afro-Cuban music and percussion. Unlike the other CD, Bataketu, which you see in front of you, which is blending Cuban and Brazilian cultures, I know both Cuban music and Brazilian music. I need to say that I don't know anything about Shona music. I just heard him play and went, that's just beautiful. And I would love an opportunity to do something with you. And then as we started to explore possibilities, we discovered all these commonalities and all these things that not just musically, but culturally and so on, that add to me much interest to the project. But if you ask me about Shona music, I will tell you that I don't know anything about it, and you need to talk to my buddy that I made the CD with. But anyhow, this is the first track, and you'll hear vocals in both the Shona language and in an Afro-Cuban language that we call Lukumi, which is a New World version of the Yoruba language of the Yoruba people of southwestern Nigeria.
How different is this version that we're listening to than the original attempts at doing it? When this was first composed to this final version.
No, not that different, because in this case, I hear all this stuff in my head. Now, the exact lengths and who's going to come in first, or, in other words, will the Shona lyric come first and then the Cuba? That's, to me, not that big of a deal. It's the actual nuts and bolts. But I think it's kind of like a house, maybe, You have this vision in your head. You already see the house in your head. Now, whether you're going to put this wall up first or that wall up first, not a big deal. It's that you already kind of see the house in your mind and how it's going to sit on the hill and kind of where you want the driveway to be and so on and so on. So I heard all this in my head as this guy was playing for me. He was playing by himself. And the whole time he was playing, I'm hearing all this going on.
You're putting in the walls.
Yeah. And then the actual sheetrock, sheetrock is a drag. I don't care. So that's just the nuts and bolts of doing it. And it's like making a film, The nuts and bolts of it aren't fun. I don't care what you say. You've got to keep your eye on the prize, or else one day you say, why do I want to be up at 5 in the morning doing this? But I kind of already hear it in my head. So then it's just a matter of
kind of working through it.
Just getting it out. You know, okay, let's record this. So I may not know how long a certain section is going to be. I just know I'm going to record a chunk of X. And then later, again, because of the great thing about digital technology is you can edit in ways that you could never have done the generation before us. So we were talking earlier about, you know, digital and analog. I adore digital technology for what it enables us to do. There's no way to make a record like this 20 years ago. Analog. Can't edit it. You know, unless you've got enough money to put 30 people in a recording studio, who's got that kind of money? So, I'm a huge digital technology fan. I guess it's like anything, you know, atomic energy can be a great thing or a terrible thing depending on what you do with it. So the fact that a lot of people do awful things with digital technology doesn't make the technology itself evil. It's just what you do with it. So I can record chunks of material and then move things around and edit them in ways so that, you know what, maybe I will put that wall over here.
And these guys have a magical voice, magical sound to them.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting that not this guy, but the guy singing the Shona lyrics is the, you know, whitest American you've ever seen. Remember Wally Cox?
Yeah.
He's kind of, you know, he's just this guy, you know, he's just this guy that should be selling you, you know, auto insurance. So you never know.
No.
I am very grateful to digital technology for enabling me to put tapestries together that in the old days could only be done with huge budgets, because you need 5 or 6 people at a console. Each guy's got, you know, and you'd have to slave 2 24 tracks to get 48 tracks, you know, and then each guy's responsible. And when you're mixing, you know, for 6 or 7 EQs and reverbs and levels, and you go, okay, everybody ready, you know, and you'd press the thing and then hope that nobody's screwed, you know. And now it's all automated and you can fade in and out. And like, just if you listen to a lot of this, well, both of these 2 CDs, there's all kinds of crossfades and fading in and fading and stuff that if you have to do by hand, the odds are you ain't going to make it, you know, and only, you know, at $150 an hour. And remember, 2-inch tape was $220 a reel by the time it became obsolete. You know, that's a fairly expensive proposition. Mm-hmm. So
the technology really has forwarded, I suppose,
absolutely,
one's ability to make music.
I believe that, absolutely. Yeah, and when everybody is all analog, and I'm like, do you really believe that, or are you just trying to be cool because you want to be...
It's like the tube amps, right?
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I suppose if I were recording just an acoustic piano in the perfect room with really warm tube amps, you know, a nice analog record. I'm not an idiot. But in general, who are you kidding? You know, by the time you have 4 or 5 musicians playing,
it's got to pass your car test.
Yeah, that's right.
Why don't you tell us about the car test?
Okay, well, you know, we mix a record and we're sitting in a recording studio in front of, you know, $3,000 speakers, like everybody at home's got their $3,000 set of speakers in a perfectly tuned room, you know, where there's no bass trap and there's no sound bouncing off of anywhere. And who are we kidding? You know, people are listening to their CD on the way to work in their car. So if you want it to sound good, put it in your car and drive around the freeway and mix your damn CD. And that's how I do it.
In the vehicle that you use?
Is my old Toyota pickup, long bed. You know, engine running, thank you very much.
Looking at some of the other people that you've played with, I'm a pretty big Stones fan. I noticed the name Charlie Watts.
Yeah. I did the West Coast leg of the Charlie Watts jazz tour. I don't know if you know that Charlie Watts is a jazz...
No, I did. I saw him at the Fillmore.
Then you saw me on that gig.
That was you?
Yeah.
I saw you there. I was there.
Yeah, well, that was me. And he liked me enough to then carry me on through the West Coast part mm-hmm. of that tour. That was a very fascinating experience. He was the nicest guy I ever met. He was a prince and utterly self-effacing. I'm not going to say we became friends. I mean, I don't think if I walked up to him on the street tomorrow, he would remember me from Adam. But for that little 5 days or whatever it was, you know, we kind of hung together. You won't remember this, but there was a big band behind him. Mm-hmm. You remember that?
Yeah.
He did not introduce the big band, but I was introduced that night. He insisted that drummers have to stick together and that if he was going to be introduced, I had to be introduced. So I was the only sideman, if you will, separate from the quintet or whatever it was that he brought mm-hmm. with him, that was introduced to the crowd. He was pretty funny about the whole business. You may recall, he didn't play a lot of solos. He had like one solo and the whole night. And at the end of the solo that night, he kind of looked at me and he went, "Wasn't very good, was it? I just love to do this." He goes, "I just love to play jazz. I'm not very good at it. Some people play golf. I play jazz." And I could sit at home and do nothing, but I have all this money and I'd rather just go out, you know, and do what I like to do. I don't like to play golf. I like to play jazz. All of him was just sort of like that, just kind of like, I can do this. I can afford to do it. So why shouldn't I do it?
So his hobby is to hire a big band behind him and play jazz music.
Why not? Do it.
Why not?
And by the way, I know other people who, back in the .com era, who CEO type people who did the same thing mm-hmm. and squandered many.
Well, what's his name? Paul Allen.
Well, right. The museum. The Borland Corporation. Well, the guy that ran that, and I think he ended up in jail. French guy.
The French guy, yeah. He worked.
Well, he fancied himself a jazz flute player. And I won't tell you the amount of money that he spent making records where he would put people in the Beverly Hills hotel for 3 months and pay them triple scale to sit around until he decided he was ready to record. And I was part of that whole little, you know, gravy train for a minute until the thing about that was that you were on call 24 hours. So if at 4 a.m. he decided that that's when he wanted to rehearse, you were on call. And then when you were playing or rehearsing, if he wanted to play for 4 hours, you weren't allowed to leave. And I said, "Well, I got to go pee." "No, you can't." I said, "No, I may be your boy, but I'm not your slave." Later. Being a musician is a tough life. I don't mean that like, oh, woe is me. But I mean, you know, tomorrow morning I'll get up at 5 to get on a plane to go to Seattle to make a 9 a.m. rehearsal to produce it. You know, it's long days, hard travel, and it's very wearing. So we're about the third day of this tour, and Charlie says to me, "Mike?" I said, "Yeah." Charlie goes, "And I'm not used to this." I said, "Used to what?" He goes, "Well, I mean, you know, the bus to the hotel to the sound check."
That's not the way they travel.
And he goes, "With the Stones, you know, well, if we travel on Tuesday, take Wednesday off." Mm-hmm. You know, and then on Thursday, the crew does the sound check, so we have Thursday off. Play Friday, well, you got to take Saturday off. You played for, he goes, I said, "Welcome back to the," he goes, "It's been 50 years since I," he goes, "I'm remembering. This is tough, isn't it?" I said, "Yeah, man, this will kick your ass."
You know, I was lucky at one point when the Stones at the MGM Grand, and we had VIP passes. So we got to go to their sound check, and we got to meet some, or they came by, and we just got to shake hands with them briefly. Charlie was the one who just sort of stayed back. And yeah. I was sort of intimidated by him. A certain aura about him. You just didn't go up and approach him. Whereas the rest of them were.
But actually, it's the opposite. He's just, he's not a rock and roll star.
He's not.
He's just a guy who plays drums.
Yeah.
So his thing is like, that's just not his thing. He's just a guy who happened to become a multimillionaire because he ended up being in the most important rock and roll band in the world. Mm-hmm. But his thing was just play drums.
Mike, many of the CDs you produced are not strictly musical. They're actually educational. They teach something about the culture of Latin percussion. Question I have for you, how important do you think that is for the ongoing survival of musicians, of the culture, of everything surrounding jazz, and more particularly Latin jazz?
I don't know that I know the answer to that. I don't sit down to make an educational CD, if you will, unlike, let's say, a book where, okay, this is a book where I'm going to teach. It's just that the music that comes out of me is a result of having to know a lot of things. You couldn't make the CDs that I make if you hadn't learned a bunch of stuff. I don't know whether education, quote unquote, matters anymore or not. I don't know the effect that that has on people any more than, let's say, education about film matters. At the end of the day, people like, you know, are moved by what you do or they're not. And the fact that there might be a whole historical context to the television show, movie, CD, painting that you make, I don't know. I know it matters to the people who are in your field, but that's not necessarily the quote-unquote joke you public. I have more and more questions in my own mind, I guess, about education and its effect when it comes to art. I'm not talking about someone who comes to you and says, I'd like to learn how to edit sound. Well, okay, then you can say, well, look, let's start with an old two-track analog tape recorder. How did you, well, here's a razor blade. I mean, now you're talking about teaching history, but for a reason. But if I just want to listen to your show at the end of the day, why do I care? I would like to say that I don't say that happily. I mean, I think one of the tragedies of the modern world is that we don't pay attention to history. We don't pay attention to lineage. We don't pay attention to our elders and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I hate to sound like, you know, my grandpa, but I'm becoming him, so what the hell? I think we're not curious anymore. We don't ask questions. I teach at hundreds of universities, quite literally hundreds. And the thing that bothers me is when I come into a university and they brought me there for a residency, let's say for a week, and I say, so what would you like to know? And there's dead silence. Nobody's curious. Kids don't know how to ask questions. They don't even know what they are interested in. You'd like to think that people are curious and they want knowledge, but most people aren't curious anymore. And whether that's a whole function of McLuhan and the medium is the message and we spoon feed them stuff and they don't have to respond, I don't know. But I don't intend to make records that are quote unquote educational, but if one wanted to look at them that way, there's an enormous amount of information and education and history in what I do, but it's not my intent. You couldn't make it unless you knew all this stuff that I know.
It's there.
It's there. If you want to look at it, whether people want to or not, I think less and less. I think I like it, I don't like it. My friend's daughter came home. This is one of my, he has two favorite stories that I will tell. The first was, Daddy, was Paul McCartney ever in a band before Wings?
I know.
Right? And, Daddy, who's Malcolm the Tenth? Now, and this wasn't an eight-year-old. So I lament the fact that, because to me it all goes hand in hand. We're not curious as people. So if you're not curious and you don't know where things came from, so then you don't respect the lineage that your stuff came from. So then you don't respect, I don't mean this funny, you don't respect your elders, you don't respect your parents. Old people get locked up in old homes because we don't think they have anything to teach us, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't mean to sound like some cliche here, but what happened to respecting your elders and what they have to teach us?
You know, over this past weekend, we took our two kids to a ballet performance, which, you know, isn't always my favorite thing to do,
sure.
but I went. And some of the people that we knew were there, this woman is Russian. And she came up to me, and she knows what I do for a living. And she asked if we would be interested in doing some podcasts focusing on kids. And I said, what do you have in mind? And what she wanted to do, she really is interested in doing podcasts that are focused on culture and gentility.
Hmm.
Where there's the love and the interest in learning and not just learning how to take a test.
Yeah.
I mean, very much analogous to what you're saying.
Yeah, and the thing is that the music that I play is, again, oral tradition, handed down, and some of it's sacred, some of it very sacred, where, you know, you got to be in the club to, you know, and so forth and so on. The whole thing is predicated on, I learned from you, you learned from him, he learned from, and you have to recite it. It's a recitation. It's not just like, wouldn't it be nice to know? You don't get in the door if you can't recite it. So-and-so begat, so-and-so begat, so, you know, biblical recitation of it as a indication of you better know where you came from. And by the way, the North Indians, Ravi Shankar, is the same. I guarantee you that guy can go, mm-hmm. I learned from this guy who took, and, you know, in our culture.
Well, now you would just Google it.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's so I don't know if I answered your question or not exactly, but all the educational stuff is in there, which is why, I mean, I think I can go to campuses and, you know, pontificate for days and days, but that's not my intent. It is the intrinsic to what I do, though.
The reason I ask is, the reason I ask is because Joel Leach, who was at Cal State Northridge and still teaches in the LA area, was a big advocate of jazz education. And 95-98% of you people will not make a living playing jazz.
Right.
But the stuff you learn here will mean that you will be consumers of jazz for the rest of your life. And so his part of his intent educating us in jazz studies was so the culture of jazz would survive from a commercial perspective.
Sure. And I co-sign that 100%. Of course, the only problem with that is that that presupposes that you're interested in learning it. And I guess what I'm questioning is how much in our culture now people want to learn anything. No, it's outside of percussion major who buys two conga drums or buys my book. Yeah, I co-sign 100%. I'm just wondering, in this day and age, who wants to learn anything? As someone who grew up in the Vietnam era, how in the world can we possibly be in Iraq if we have any sense of history? So the only answer can be that Americans are not interested in any history because it's only 40 years later, and look what the, and it's the same. Things are getting better and we're turning the corner. And I mean, it might as well just be, you know, a Richard Nixon quote or right down the line.
But look at that. I mean, I think it was in Parade magazine recently where they asked young adults, whatever the definition of young adults, where Iraq was, showed them a map.
Yeah.
And they didn't know where it
was. Well, of course not. And just saying then that it's hard to answer your question when I don't get that as a society, we're interested in learning any history of anything.
Yeah. When curiosity dies, then history dies.
That's right. And that is my biggest gripe. Young people, did I love it? You know, all of a sudden here I am, you know, no curiosity. And I have fights with students on campuses about this. I did a residency at a campus once where part of the deal was that I was supposed to go to every music class. They want that so that the opera singer still goes to the Latin jazz class. The whole point being that you should get exposed to the whole thing. And I walk into the theory and composition class, and the teacher says, we're so lucky to have this, you know, famous Mike Spiro, and you've got an hour and a half with him, and let's take advantage of it. And, you know, he's here just to talk about his life. And so please have at it. Dead silence. One guy's reading his book. And so then she tries again, and, you know, and like this. And finally, then I got mad, not out of, you know, who the heck cares who Mike Spire is? I don't even know who Mike Spire is. And all of a sudden, like, now you can hear, you know, if you thought you could hear a pin drop before.
Yeah, right.
I said, you know what, man? I don't have a gun to your head. I didn't tell you to come in here today. I don't care that you don't want to talk to me. I care that you don't have any manners. Where are your manners? You know? Didn't your mama raise you right? There's a guest in your classroom, and you don't have to be here. Now get out. So I threw him out, and then I said, you know, you people piss me off. I said, I never heard of Mike Spire either, so I don't really expect anybody to care about Mike Spiro, but I do expect you to be curious. Who the hell is this guy? And I must have something together, because I make my living doing this, and you're all students hoping to make your living. Don't you want to know, how do I get a gig? How do I keep a gig? What do I make? How do I pay my bills? How do I get to the gig? How did I book this gig? You know, I'm not a big opera fan, to be honest here, kids, but You know what? I could spend a week with an opera singer going, you're already booked in 2009? Do you have a manager? How much do you pay a manager? How do you learn to sing in five languages? Do you know what you're singing? Do you learn? In other words, what happened to just human curiosity? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden they started to, you know, respond to me. But I said, why do I have to call you all to get you to be a curious human being? And that's the part that trips me out about, it doesn't matter where you go, including Ivy League, junior college, somewhere. It's across the spectrum. Is it on the test? If it's not on the test, I don't care.
It's the test.
I think our children are trained. In fact, given the moves in public education towards mass testing and you know, statistically looking at how the body of students do, students are increasingly trained not to be curious, but how to take tests.
Sure. And well, my kid, I just spent $500, I think, maybe something like that, which was half price. So my kid could take the how to take the SAT test. You know, does he know how to think? I don't know, but he sure as hell knows how to take the damn SAT test, or he damn well better at $500. Yeah. So anyhow, that's, you know, my point then is, I know that was a strange answer to your question, or maybe what you expected, but I don't know whether the educational part of my music really matters to anybody or not.
Thanks a lot, Mike. We really appreciate it.
Totally. My pleasure.
It was fun.
My pleasure. Nice to speak with intelligent people about all the things.
Did you get that part?
That we do. Did you get that? Did you
get that? If you'd like to have ApplauseCast produce a podcast for you or your organization, email us at sales@applausecast.com or call us at 650-400-3929. If you'd like to leave us email regarding tonight's podcast, drop us a line at ontheair@applausecast.com. This has been an ApplauseCast production. Thanks for listening.